All right, let's jump into this deep dive into Mark, specifically Mark 14, verses 26 through 72. We've got Dr. Mark Jennings's lecture to unpack here. And it seems like you're really interested in what the disciples were going through in those final hours with Jesus.
Yeah, it's just, you know, such an intense period leading up to the crucifixion. Really fascinating to see how they react.
Absolutely. And I mean, right off the bat, we're in the thick of it. Right after that Last Supper, Jesus drops this bombshell. He's like, one of you is going to betray me.
Yeah.
And you'd think, like, immediate finger pointing, right? Accusations flying around. But it's not like that at all. It's like they're all in denial.
Yeah, they all ask, surely not I. But, you know, the irony that Jennings points out, only Judas betrays Jesus, but all the disciples end up abandoning him.
That is such a good point. It's like fear just takes over, overrides any loyalty they have in that moment. And then he ties it back to that Old Testament prophecy, Zechariah 13.7, about the shepherd being struck down, sheep scattering. It's such a powerful image.
Oh, it really is. It foreshadows, you know, what's about to happen to Jesus. But also, it kind of speaks to like a larger truth about humanity, right? That even those closest to Jesus who have witnessed his miracles, they can still, you know, falter when fear takes over.
It makes you wonder, is Mark kind of suggesting that this could happen to anyone, even those who, you know, consider themselves super devout?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, he seems very interested in this, in exploring the complexity of faith, right?
Yeah.
Even among those who are supposed to be like Jesus's closest followers. But you know, even in this bleak moment where they realize they're all going to abandon him, Jesus offers a glimmer of hope. He promises to meet them again in Galilee after his resurrection.
It's like such reassurance. Even though they're going to fail him, his love, his plan, it remains unchanged. It's really comforting.
Absolutely. It speaks to the unwavering nature of God's grace, even in the face of, you know, human weakness. And so from this weighty conversation about betrayal and abandonment, we shift to the Garden of Gethsemane.
And Jesus's isolation just becomes so much more intense, right? Like the weight of everything that's about to happen is just pressing in on him.
Totally. And Jennings highlights this progression, right? Jesus starts with the whole group of disciples, then he narrows it down to just Peter, James, and John. And then finally, he's alone praying in anguish.
And this isn't just some random garden, right? Gethsemane, it was possibly an olive grove, maybe even a place that Jesus, you know, frequented.
It does add a layer of intimacy to the scene, doesn't it?
It does.
This place that's familiar, maybe even comforting, becomes the setting for this, for Jesus's deepest agony. And Mark describes his soul as overwhelmed with sorrow, almost to the point of death.
Yeah, the language is so raw, so visceral. And then there's the way he addresses God, Abba, Father. It's just, it's not a typical, you know, formal prayer.
No, not at all. Abba, as Jennings explains, is like a term of endearment, almost like daddy, you know. It's really unprecedented in Jewish tradition.
Yeah.
And it highlights that unique intimacy of Jesus' relationship with God.
It makes his anguish even more real. He's not just facing death, but facing it while feeling this immense love responsibility for humanity.
Right. And this weight, it's symbolized by the cup he prays to have taken from him. And in the Old Testament, that cup often represents God's wrath and judgment.
So is Jesus asking to escape judgment then? To, you know, get out of this whole crucifixion thing?
I don't think so. Remember, Jesus has been talking about his death, like, throughout Mark's gospel. He knows what's coming. I think what's interesting here is that he acknowledges this very human desire to avoid suffering, right? Even as he submits to God's will.
Yeah, and then there's that phrase, the hour. And it's clear it's not just about, like, you know, a time on the clock.
Exactly. Jennings connects it to, like, broader eschatological themes. It's not a 60-minute period. It's this, like, cosmic turning point, the moment where prophecies start to be fulfilled.
So knowing what we know now, the disciples repeatedly falling asleep, it's almost absurd, right? Like, they're dozing off during this pivotal moment in history. What do you think about that? Their inability to really grasp what was happening.
It's such a stark contrast to the disciples we saw earlier in Mark, right? Remember when James and John boldly claimed they could drink the cup Jesus was about to drink?
Oh, right. Back in chapter 10, talk about a reality check.
Totally. It highlights this huge gap between their understanding and the reality of what Jesus is going through. They're still operating on this human level while Jesus is grappling with the weight of, like, cosmic significance. And this contrast, it just becomes even more stark as we move into the betrayal and the arrest.
So we left off with Peter's denial, and those Jewish leaders are ready to hand Jesus over to the Roman authorities. It's almost like they've just washed their hands of him. But, you know, Jennings makes it clear that they're still kind of pulling strings behind the scenes.
Oh, absolutely. You can't forget that, you know, even though the Romans are the ones who are going to actually carry out the crucifixion, Mark is very careful to show that it's the Jewish authorities who really set this whole chain of events in motion.
So let's unpack this Roman trial a bit. What are some of the key things that Jennings highlights here?
Well, first off, I think he points out that Mark portrays Pilate as almost like disinterested. The whole trial seems kind of rushed, perfunctory. And Pilate doesn't really seem all that convinced by these charges that they're bringing against Jesus. He even expresses, you know, some skepticism.
That's interesting because everything I've read about Pilate, he's got this reputation for being like ruthless, decisive. So why this hesitation with Jesus?
Well, Jennings suggests that maybe Pilate just saw Jesus as kind of a harmless religious fanatic, you know, not a real threat to Roman authority.
Yeah.
And plus, he probably didn't want to stir up any trouble with the Jewish leaders, especially during Passover. You know, tensions are already running high.
Yeah, real political tightrope walk, isn't it? Pilate's trying to balance, you know, Roman interest with local sensitivities. And then you've got the Jewish authorities just trying to use the whole situation to get rid of Jesus.
Exactly. And then you've got this really intriguing detail about Barabbas. Jennings explains that Pilate offered to release a prisoner as like a gesture of goodwill during Passover. Seems like it was a custom at the time.
It's such a classic setup, isn't it? The crowd gets to choose a known criminal or this man who's been accused of, you know, claiming to be king. Talk about a lose-lose situation for Jesus.
Right. And the crowd, you know, urged on by the chief priests, they choose Barabbas. And just like that, Jesus's fate is sealed. Jennings points out that, you know, this scene, it just further implicates the Jewish authorities. They've basically manipulated the crowd, forced Pilate's hand.
It's just this chilling reminder of how easily religious fervor can be twisted to serve these political agendas. But one thing that really strikes me is how silent Jesus is during this whole Roman trial. You know, after that bold declaration before the Sanhedrin, you'd think he would, I don't know, put up more of a fight.
It is a powerful silence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jennings doesn't really delve into the reasons behind it, but it almost seems like Jesus is refusing to, I don't know, legitimize this system that's already decided to condemn him.
Yeah, he's not playing their game. He's on a whole other level.
And that silence, it's in such stark contrast to all the noise and commotion around him. You know, the accusations, the political maneuvering, the crowd's just like bloodlust. It's in that silence that we see the depth of his submission to God's will.
So despite that initial hesitation, Pilate caves to the pressure, condemns Jesus to crucifixion. And yeah, it's a Roman execution carried out by Roman soldiers. But Jennings keeps reminding us that Mark is kind of pointing the finger back at the Jewish leaders.
He doesn't let them off the hook. I mean, they're the ones who instigated this whole thing, right? They're manipulating events to achieve their goal.
It makes you wonder, you know, maybe Mark's audience might have been tempted to lay all the blame at the feet of the Romans. He seems to be challenging that assumption.
It's very possible. Remember, Mark's gospel was most likely written for a community that was experiencing persecution. So, you know, they might have been looking for someone to blame, right? Seeking an outlet for their anger, their grief. And Mark seems to be saying, hey, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah. Reminds us that accountability isn't always, you know, clear cut. It can be messy, uncomfortable, especially when you're talking about like religious and political power dynamics.
And speaking of messy and uncomfortable, the narrative now shifts to, you know, all those gruesome details of the crucifixion. Mark definitely doesn't shy away from the brutality, but he also highlights these moments of kind of unexpected compassion in the midst of all this suffering.
Right. You're talking about Simon of Cyrene, right?
Yeah.
The guy who's forced to carry Jesus's cross.
Yes. Jennings points out that this seemingly minor detail actually carries like so much theological weight. Simon, you know, he's a foreigner, but he's compelled to share in Jesus's burden.
It's like he's representing all of humanity being called to participate in Christ's suffering.
Totally.
Yeah.
It foreshadows this idea that Jesus' sacrifice isn't just for one nation or one group, but for all people.
And then you've got the detail about the women who are witnessing the crucifixion from afar. Jennings mentions that Mark actually names these women, which is, you know, kind of unusual for this gospel.
Yeah, he's right. It really suggests that they played a significant role in the early Christian community. Maybe even as like eyewitnesses to the resurrection.
It's fascinating how Mark includes these details that highlight the diversity of people who are drawn to Jesus. Even in this like darkest hour, you've got Simon, the foreigner, you've got these faithful women standing by, while a lot of the male disciples have fled.
Yeah, it challenges those assumptions we might have about like who's considered important or, you know, faithful.
For sure. And even on the cross, you see this diversity of responses to Jesus. Jennings points out that one of the criminals who's crucified alongside him, he's mocking Jesus, while the other one recognizes him as the King of the Jews.
Yeah, it's like a microcosm of the different ways that people respond to Jesus' claims, right?
Right.
Rejection, mockery, but then genuine faith, even when they're facing death.
And then, of course, you have that just gut-wrenching moment when Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's a quote from Psalm 22, right?
It is. And Jennings explains that, you know, this cry, it's not like a cry of despair or anything like that, but rather it's like this really profound expression of identification with humanity's suffering.
Like in that moment, Jesus is taking on the full weight of human pain, that separation from God.
He's not just like sympathizing with our suffering, he's entering into it, you know, experiencing it firsthand. And this is, I think, what makes the crucifixion so powerful. It's not just about a man dying. It's about God entering into the depths of human brokenness and redeeming it from within.
It's almost too much to comprehend, you know, that God would love us that much.
I know. And then right after this agonizing cry, Jesus breathes his last breath. And then something incredible happens.
The curtain of the temple, it's torn in two, right, from top to bottom.
Yes. Jennings explains that this symbolizes like the breaking down of barriers between humanity and God. Through Jesus' death, that access to God's presence is now open to all. We no longer need priests or sacrifices.
Yeah. You know?
We can approach God directly because of what Jesus has done.
It's like that whole old sacrificial system. It's just rendered obsolete. It's replaced by this new covenant sealed in Jesus' blood. And then you've got this just like incredible declaration from the Roman centurion who witnesses the crucifixion. He says, truly, this man was the Son of God.
It's a powerful statement, especially coming from, you know, Gentile and outsider.
Okay.
It underscores that universal scope of Jesus' sacrifice. It's not just for the Jews, but for all humanity.
It's almost like a preview of the gospel spreading beyond Jerusalem, you know, into the Gentile world. And in the midst of all this drama and this upheaval, Jennings reminds us that those faithful women, they're still there watching from afar.
Yeah, they're unwavering in their loyalty to Jesus, even in death. It's such a powerful contrast to the disciples' abandonment.
Yeah.
And really a testament to the depth of their faith. And these women, they're going to play a crucial role in the next part of our deep dive when we look at the discovery of the empty tomb and those resurrection appearances.
This is where things get really interesting. Can't wait to explore those stories with you and see what kind of insights Jennings offers. Stay tuned, because we're about to dive into one of the most pivotal moments in human history.
Welcome back. We've been on quite a journey through Mark 14. Betrayal, denial, the agony of the crucifixion. But now we get to the event that changes everything. The resurrection. It really is the cornerstone of Christian faith, isn't it? But Jennings, he points out that Mark's account is actually pretty sparse. Like, we don't get a detailed description of the resurrection itself, just the discovery of the empty tomb and the angel's message.
Huh. That is interesting. It's almost like Mark is less concerned with, you know, the mechanics of the resurrection and more interested in the impact on those who encounter it.
I think you're right. The focus is on the experience, the bewilderment, the awe that the resurrection evokes. And who are the first to experience this? The women? The ones who remained faithful to Jesus, you know, throughout his suffering.
The same women who were watching from afar as Jesus was being crucified. They stayed loyal when the disciples had scattered.
Exactly. They go to the tomb expecting to anoint Jesus' body. But instead, they find the stone rolled away. And a young man dressed in white just sitting there inside.
It's like their steadfast loyalty is rewarded with this incredible revelation. They're the first to witness the impossible, the empty tomb.
And the angel's message, it's so crucial, too. He tells them, he has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But then he adds something really interesting. He says, but go, tell his disciples and Peter.
That inclusion of Peter, that's huge. After denying Jesus three times, I mean, he must have been feeling just completely devastated, unworthy.
Oh, absolutely. And yet the angel specifically mentions him, extending that direct invitation to, you know, rejoin the community. It's a powerful reminder that God's grace, it's available, even in those, you know, really dark moments when we fail.
Yeah, no matter how badly we mess up, there's always a path back, forgiveness, restoration. But then we get this really strange detail. Mark says that the women, instead of rejoicing, rushing to tell everyone, they're actually terrified. They say nothing to anyone because they're afraid.
Yeah, that detail is often overlooked. But I think Jennings is right to highlight it. Adds a layer of realism to the story. These women have just encountered something utterly mind-blowing, something that challenges everything they thought they knew about, like life and death. I mean, wouldn't you be terrified?
I think I would be if I stumbled upon an empty tomb and a messenger from heaven. It makes their silence, even though, you know, from a modern perspective, it's frustrating, it's understandable. And like Jennings mentioned earlier, they're women in a very patriarchal society, so their testimony wouldn't have carried much weight anyway.
It adds another layer to the challenges they're facing, right? They've seen the impossible, but will anyone believe them? And this kind of leads us to one of the most debated parts of Mark's gospel, the ending.
Yes. The short ending versus the long ending. Tell me about it. What's the controversy?
So some ancient manuscripts of Mark, they actually end very abruptly with verse 8, leaving out any resurrection appearances. But most modern Bibles, they include this longer ending where Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene, to two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and then finally to the 11 disciples.
So which ending is the correct one?
Well, Jennings, he presents both sides of that scholarly debate. But he ultimately argues for the authenticity of that longer ending. He points out that it's the version that's found in most, like, early church writings, and that it fits better with the overall themes of Mark's gospel.
Well, I'm glad we have that longer ending, because those resurrection appearances are just amazing. It's so fascinating how each encounter has, like, a slightly different feel. You know, it reveals different aspects of who Jesus is now that he's risen.
They really are transformative.
Yeah.
And not just for the individuals who encounter Jesus, but also for, like, the future of the Christian movement.
The disciples go from, like, terrified and scattered to these bold proclaimers of the risen Christ. It's like the resurrection doesn't just vindicate Jesus's claims, but it empowers his followers to carry on his mission.
It's a crucial point, you know. The resurrection isn't just about an individual event. It's about the birth of a movement.
And that final commission to preach the gospel to all nations is just huge. Shows that Mark sees this good news of Jesus's resurrection as something meant for the whole world, not just a select few.
That universal scope, I think that's really at the heart of the Christian message.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what Jennings wants us to grasp as we, you know, come to the end of this deep dive into Mark 14. We've seen the depths of human despair, the betrayal, denial, the agony of the crucifixion. But we've also seen that unwavering love of God, the triumph of hope over fear, the power of forgiveness, and that promise of new life that just bursts forth from the empty tomb.
It's a story that continues to resonate, even thousands of years later, reminding us that even in our darkest moments when everything seems lost, there's always hope. The tomb is empty, Christ is risen, and that changes everything.
So as you reflect on this deep dive, ask yourself, what part of this story speaks to you most powerfully? How does Jesus's example of, like, unwavering faith, how does that challenge you? And how might you, like those early disciples, be empowered to share that good news, that resurrection hope, with the world around you?
Thanks for joining us on this incredible journey through Mark 14. We hope this deep dive has given you some new insights and a deeper appreciation for the power of this ancient story. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep the faith.